I'm very happy now to welcome Don Mitchell. He's author of the new book, Flying Blind, One Man's Adventures Battling Buckthorn, Making Peace with Authority, and Creating a Home for Endangered Bats. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So this is a memoir about your life on a farm that you and your wife bought about four decades ago. And it's a book about many kinds of relationships, relationships with nature, with people, and with the government. You were a conscientious objector during the Vietnam War, and you had a generally rebellious attitude toward authority. And then you found out that the government provided all kinds of help to farmers. What happened?
Well, I'd say my wife and I came to Vermont in 1972 because a sidebar in the Whole Earth Catalog, and anybody can recall that publication, had recommended that all the long-haired, disaffected young people move to Vermont because, this writer said, it's a very small state so we could take it over quickly. And in many ways, the influx of young people at that time did change the character and the culture of Vermont. We began raising sheep because at the time there was a generous government price support program for wool. And I'm sure people in the Southwest are familiar with that as well. And in fact, it was profitable to feed a sheep through the winter, whether she had a lamb or not, because the wool program was so generous. So that was my introduction to some of the bizarre things that the government spends money on. The rationale for that program was that it was felt that you could not make a good military uniform without some wool content. And so wool was a commodity of strategic importance to the military. And that justified the government's assuring a domestic captive supply of wool. But that situation changed after the fall of the Soviet Union and the warehouses of wool in Australia were opened up. And like a lot of government programs, it had a short functional life and then it became toast. In 2006, I was approached by a government wildlife biologist who asked if he could try and trap bats on our farm. And I said, you know, bats give me the willies, but if you want to give it a try, be my guest. Just don't bother me. And he was quite successful trapping bats here, including bats of the Indiana bat species, which has been endangered federally since 1967. And a year later, the first reports of white nose syndrome, this fungal infection that has killed millions of bats now in North America, the first reports of that infection came out of the Albany, New York area, and I was made aware that there was yet another government program that would give me some expertise and pay me some money, and actually an embarrassingly small amount of money, not if the work is done, to enhance the habitat for bats that had been found to exist in the woods on the farm. So that's how I got into the government program to help the bats.
Which we'll talk about in a moment, but I think it was interesting that early on, after you had established yourself on the farm, you decided you were going to build a pond, and there was a government program to help people build ponds on their land. But it's such an illustration of the kind of help that you can get. On the one hand, they help you with planning and expense, and on the other hand, they kind of take over and they do it in their way, which is not necessarily the best way.
Well, if you build a pond that's been engineered by government soil conservation engineers, then you have to build it to their specifications. And they don't want to see an earthen dam ever give way in 100 years and create soil erosion and pollution downstream. So I think this is characteristic of all these government programs that hand out money to cooperating citizens. They come with a lot of strings attached.
Meanwhile, when you built this pond, you suddenly started seeing a lot of bats. Why did they show up all of a sudden?
Well, the bats were already roosting in the woods on the farm. And bats, at least in the Northeast, they spend their summers hunting insects at night in the woods. They spend their summer days sleeping in trees and very particular kinds of trees, and we'll get into that, I'm sure, in a minute. And if it's a lactating female, as dusk comes and it's safe for them to to leave their tree roosts, the first thing they want to do is get some water, because lactation is profoundly dehydrating on a hot summer day. So they would head straight to the pond and kind of like dive bomb it to get a few gulps of water as evening began. So the pond's presence really enhanced the habitat for these bats.
It also enhanced the habitat for a lot of other creatures. And one thing that I found amazing was you build this pond, which comes from a little stream that was there. And after a while, there are fish. How do fish, fish don't fly. How do they get there?
I think they arrive as eggs, row on the feet of aquatic birds. And then the eggs drop off the bird's feet when the bird hits the water. And then the eggs hatch and become fish. And we also, the pond also gave us muskrats and otters, at one time beaver, raccoons. If you give a wild animal the habitat that it's seeking, sooner or later it's going to show up.
Yeah. Build it and they will come. Let's talk more about bats. So over the course of time, you really fell in love with these creatures. Tell us more about them. What are they like? They're very ancient.
Yeah, love might be too strong a word, but not too much too strong. Certainly the profoundest respect and admiration for how they do business in the ecosystem. When I got into it, I learned that 22% of all mammalian species happen to be bats, which represents a huge amount of evolutionary energy going into the idea of a mammal that can fly. And they fly because their hands grew enormous, and a membrane evolved between the bones of the fingers so that Chiroptera, which is the taxonomical name for bats, actually references the word for hand and wing in Greek. So the bats are hand wings. And that means that they don't fly the way a bird does. They can manipulate their wings with all the dexterity that we can do with our fingers and our wrists. So they can go any place in the air. They can go up, down, sideways, hover. They can move in the medium of air the way a fish can move in water. And then, in addition, they evolved this marvelous adaptation called echolocation. Bats are not blind, but they would not be nearly as successful hunting insects in the dark in the forest if they hadn't evolved this system. It's almost like sonar in a ship at sea. So they emit a loud ultrasonic cry, and then they can evaluate the acoustic shadow of that cry that comes back to their ears and tells them whether they're about to run into a tree branch or whether there's a mosquito over there. And then they go and get the mosquito. And these bats in the Northeast, I know you have different species in the Southwest, like the Mexican three-tailed bat, and I'm not on top of those, but the bats we have in the Northeast can easily hunt and chow down a couple thousand insects in the course of a summer night. So they're constantly keeping pressure on the insect population that otherwise would be eating crops or defoliating trees or giving rise to more mosquitoes, who are not just a nuisance to humans, but are actually a vector in several diseases that can sicken and kill humans. So bats are always out there performing ecosystem functions of great benefit to humanity.
What is this white nose syndrome that you described earlier? It's a disease that a lot of bats are getting and a lot of bats are dying from.
It's a fungal infection that was first found in a particular bat cave near Albany, New York, a cave called Howe's Cavern, which is in a way to the Albany area as Carlsbad Caverns would be to New Mexico. And what was discovered was bats in hibernation with a powdered sugar-like substance on their noses, and in addition, far more bats lying dead on the floor of that cave than would be ordinarily expected. And at first, scientists, biologists in North America had no idea what they were dealing with, but they knew that it was spreading. And by the next winter, it was killing bats in Vermont and Massachusetts. And by now it's spread to 22 states and 5 provinces of Canada. There was a recorded case near the Oklahoma Panhandle in 2010. That's not too far away from you. And what it does, this fungus disturbs the bats as they're trying to sleep through the winter. It gives rise to like a skin irritation, almost like eczema. And the bats wake up and begin to fly around their caves going crazy with this itch during the months when they should be sleeping and saving their fat reserves to get them through the winter. So they die of starvation caused by an irritation that the fungus triggers. And it's now reliably believed that at least 7 million bats in North America have died of this. But then it was learned a couple of years later that the very same fungus is endemic in the bat caves of Western Europe. In fact, you can take a cotton swab and run it along the wall of a bat cave in France or Spain or Germany and get the exact same fungus growing in the petri dish. So in all likelihood, that fungus arrived in North America from Europe around 2006. And since the cave where it first showed up is a tourist attraction, House Cabin, and has been a tourist attraction since the 1840s, anybody can buy a ticket and go down in that cave. It's very likely that somebody was caving in Western Europe, got on an airplane, came to New York, went to that cave near Albany, bought a ticket, and had a few spores of this infection on their boots or on their jacket or on their camera. And since the North American bat population had not evolved or grown up in the presence of this fungus, they had no means to cope with it. So it's yet another story about what it means to live in the world that's become globalized, where people and goods and infections can cross borders easily.
Right. It's like, in a way, going to a country where you aren't used to the water. The locals can drink it, you drink it, and you get horribly sick.
Exactly, yeah. Or other examples of infection based upon new contact. For example, smallpox, when the European settlers first came to North America. And almost immediately, native populations were being decimated by this smallpox disease that they had no means of coping with, although the Europeans did. In Europe, this fungus, which now has had its genome sequenced and has a Latin name, this fungus does not kill the bats, even though they can be seen with evidence of it on their bodies. And there's two strong hypotheses, and one is that the fungus and the bats in Europe may have co-evolved over millions of years. And the other hypothesis is that the European bats may have acquired some behavioral strategies that allow them to cope with the disease, even though it's present on their bodies. Specifically, the European bats have been noticed to arouse themselves from hibernation every few weeks, but they don't go flying around the caves like maniacs, as is happening here. They just do some careful grooming. They clean up to keep the fungus's growth in check. And perhaps if some North American bats discover that behavior and impart it to their young, then we'll be out of this mess. But in any infectious disease scenario, the body counts are always the most dramatic, where the disease is expanding into a new population. And it would take those that are vulnerable, the young, the old, the ones that are susceptible. And eventually the population gets winnowed down to some cohort that knows something or has some resistance or can somehow withstand the challenge.
So the disappearance of bats due to this fungus, this white nose syndrome fungus, is huge. I mean, is it analogous to the colony collapse disorder that we see among bees?
I think it's actually better understood than the colony collapse disorder, because people are still scratching their heads about exactly what's going on with that. Is it pesticides? Is it the Roa mite? Is it the fact that hives are being trucked around from one farm to another? And so the bats become, the bees become, in a sense, deranged. But they're both, I would say, consequences of of human action, human interference with the natural order of the ecosystem by allowing infections, mites, parasites to travel across borders and across boundaries.
We're talking to Don Mitchell, author of the book Flying Blind, One Man's Adventures Battling Buckthorn, Making Peace with Authority, and Creating a Home for Endangered Bats. Several years ago, you found a government program that would cut your property taxes if you came up with a forest management plan, and you were able to find a plan whose primary objective was to provide and improve habitat for bats. Now, this brought you in contact with some amazing people and tremendous amount of new knowledge about how bats live and what kinds of trees, for example, are hospitable and inhospitable for bats.
I have so much respect for the wildlife biologists who figured out the behavioral patterns of these creatures who were really difficult to study under the best of circumstances. By trapping bats in their habitat and then examining them to see what their health status is and seeing what species the bat is and then banding them so that when they're found again, they can work back to where that bat was trapped and banded and on what date. They've learned that the bats that spend the summers on our farm spend the winters in caves about 100 miles south of here, and that these bats can live for 15 years, 20 years, and will come back to the same forest summer after summer, and indeed go back to the same caves every winter. And there are particular trees that the bats will favor to make their daytime roosts in, and one in particular is called the shagbark hickory tree. I doubt that you have that in the Southwest. But it's an enormous and slow-growing tree whose bark exfoliates, hangs off of the trunk in broad, flat shingles. And the bats crawl up beneath those shingles of bark and hang upside down to sleep during the day. And when they get beneath that shingle of bark, they feel safe from predation and comfortably warm. But the bats won't choose that tree unless it has a rather specific combination of direct sunlight on the bole of the trunk so the bats will stay warm, but also enough connection to surrounding forest canopy so that when the bats emerge at night to go hunting, they won't be picked off by an owl or a hawk or some other creature that predates on bats. And if an owl senses the presence of bats in a tree, they'll stake it out and wait for the bats to emerge. If they can't emerge into forest canopy, they're going to be picked off. So this wildlife biologist working for the state of Vermont would walk in the woods with me, and we'd come to a shagbark hickory tree, and he'd look around and he'd say, you know, he'd stare up into the canopy and say, if I was a bat, I think I'd go over that way. Oh, then I'd come down this way. Then he'd look around and say, I think you should cut down that maple tree over there, but leave the white oak, and cut down that hardhack, but maybe leave that white ash. And he would mark the trees that if I took them out, thinning the forest very lightly, the hickory trees would be more apt to be favored by bats as roosting trees. So I spent 3 years off and on doing that work. And I could only do it in the winter when bats were not in the woods. Otherwise, I might have scared them, me and my chainsaw. And when the work was finished, the biologists came back, and this was in the summer of 2012. And despite the very serious ravages of white-nose syndrome, they were able to trap bats here again. And in particular, they trapped an Indiana bat that was a pregnant female. And these Indianas are now as scarce as hen's teeth. So, I mean, I can't say that I saved the bats. That would be much too broad a claim. But I didn't hurt them, and I know that they're still here.
And in doing this, I think you're walking that interesting line between management and wildness. So you've got this essentially wild piece of land, but you have to manage it. And one of the reasons you have to manage it is because of invasive species.
Right. Because it was a government contract, before I could open up the woods at all by taking down certain trees, I was required to control four different invasive plants that had made their way into the woods. And, you know, there are different invasives in every different part of the country. And the ones that I was fighting, one is called buckthorn, a very aggressive plant that grows up into thickets that become impenetrable, and that does not, if you cut it down, it won't die. You have to then poison the stump with a glyphosate product or some other kind of herbicide. And a plant called garlic mustard, and a couple of others, Japanese barberry, a honeysuckle that's held to be exotic. And so I spent hundreds of hours, much of it on my hands and knees, battling these invasives to satisfy the government's expectations of this contract. And the irony did not escape me that in order to try and help some bat species that were in trouble, I had been detailed to wage genocide on some plants that really, really want to grow here, but just in a way that is held to be too competitive for the local plants. And with hundreds of hours of time on my hands to think as I did this kind of stupid work, I mean, the garlic mustard had to be pulled out by hand, by the roots. And I'd just sit down in the garlic mustard patch, and there would go the afternoon, pulling out plants and stuffing them in plastic bags so the seeds wouldn't germinate. And my thoughts kept coming back, among other things, to different metaphors for the ways in which human beings interact with the natural world, because that's what I was doing. And two predominant metaphors seemed to be humankind as the king of nature, the dominator, the person in charge, and humankind as the gardener, the nurturer, the kinder, gentler iteration of the human nature interface. The program I was working for, the name of the program was WHIP, W-H-I-P, which stands for Wildlife Habitat Incentive Program. But, you know, names mean something, and acronyms have connotations, and it became quickly clear to me that I was working for a piece of the bureaucracy whose dominant metaphor for the human nature interface was one of dominion rather than nurturing. They wanted to whip nature into shape. They wanted to whip me into shape. And so I couldn't help being somebody who came of age as an adolescent in the Vietnam era and had severe bad feelings toward the government and the way that it could wield its authority. For my whole life, I couldn't help but respond at times in anger to the premises and principles of the program I was working for. But I'm not going to bang on the government too hard, because at the end of the day, what we did here worked for the bats' benefit. And if you ask yourself, who in the world is going to identify a rogue ecosystem event like white nose syndrome in bats and then construct a policy apparatus that can respond to it in some meaningful way, it's going to take something like a government to make that happen. Individual citizens aren't going to do it. Teaching institutions aren't going to get the job done. It's going to take a government. And with that, you're going to have some bureaucracy. You're going to have red tape. You're going to have turf wars between agents and agencies with overlapping zones of responsibility. And all those things couldn't help but raise my hackles. And in the book, I certainly go into that. But the bottom line is that what they proposed to do for the bats in the woods on my farm seems to have been successful.
And it's interesting, too, because, I mean, all these hours that you spent working in nature and looking at the, just kind of receiving the metaphors that nature offers up when you spend almost any amount of time alone by yourself outdoors. One of them that I thought was so interesting and so important was the distinction between authority, like earned authority on the one hand, and authoritarianism on the other, and your own relationship to those things. And so it was, I mean, this is a beautiful memoir because it's, among other things, a process, a description of the process by which you kind of unraveled your own life story.
My father had just died when I began this work. I was 62 when he had died at the age of 93. And he had been a profoundly authoritarian figure in my life. And I have a lot of of work to do, psychological work, to interrogate our relationship and try and understand what was going on. And it was impossible for me to even ask the right questions while he was alive. That's how afraid I was of him. He could be an intimidating figure. He certainly was for me. And so a lot of my thought process had to do with the nature of authority. On the other hand, I had the model of this wildlife biologist. His name is Scott Darling, Vermont's guru of bat behavior. And he would come here and was so comfortable sharing his detailed expertise and not demanding that I do exactly what he said, get in line, and so forth and so on. And I realized that there's a profound distinction between being an authoritarian in your personal style or in your institutional style. And if you are, then the hallmark of it is you demand people's respect. And being an authority, on the other hand, which just means you know what you're talking about. You've got the goods. And the kind of expertise that comes with authority, I would say, it doesn't demand respect, but it commands respect. You just can't help but be in awe of the specialized knowledge that somebody can bring to any particular field of human endeavor. So that was a huge distinction, huge realization to make in my mid-60s. I thought my personality had been founded in rebellion against authority figures, but actually it was rebellion against authoritarian figures. But there's a place for authority, and I came to honor and to respect it.
Meanwhile, how are bats doing overall on your land? You've got bats, and you've even got some rare species of bats, and they seem to be thriving. What about in the bigger picture?
Well, the infection is still spreading across North America and Canada, heading ever further west. And the body counts on the frontiers of this disease are apt to be serious. And I know that it's heading your way, and great precautions have already been taken to places like Carlsbad to try and stave off the infection. If you want to go into Carlsbad cabins, they want to know where you've been. And if you've been caving, they will make you decontaminate yourself before you're allowed underground, else you can't go down there. In Vermont, for the period roughly 2010 to 2012, nobody was seeing bats with any frequency. They just seemed to have disappeared from the landscape. But this past summer, not just here but elsewhere, there are many more anecdotal reports of bat sightings. On this farm, you can go in the woods in the evening and look up, and you will see bats. I mean, they are there. So I think in the Northeast, by this point, probably just about every bat that's still alive has already been exposed to white nose syndrome. And the ones that are left are the ones that can somehow cope with some degree of success with the infection. It's going to take a long time to rebuild the bat population to its former robust state. And some species of bats we know are much more at risk and at risk of extinction than some others. A female bat only has one pup per summer. Half of those pups are going to be males, so they're not going to, you know, be able to raise their own pups. Not every female is going to live to maturity or indeed be fertile. So there's one species of bat we have in Vermont called the little brown bat. Formerly we thought to have had a population of 600,000 of these bats, and it's estimated to have been whacked back to less than 10% of that figure. Well, to rebuild that population could take easily 100, 200 years, given the normal breeding habits of that species.
And meanwhile, you have a situation where when you have fewer bats, you've got insect proliferations.
Yes, and also insect pests eating farmers' crops and defoliating trees. So, the ecosystem is a very complicated puzzle or web, and you can't draw a straight line and say, if this happens, this would definitely happen. No scientist, I'm told, would say this, simply because we've lost all these bats. The mosquito population is going to burgeon, and we're all going to be dying of equine encephalitis and West Nile virus. And so you can't make a straight line connection, but there will be consequences. Bats occupy an important space in the ecosystem, and their removal is going to have consequences.
Are you hopeful that they're on their way back?
Well, I am, in part because we now see them much more frequently as of this past summer. But also, we now know that there are some bat species that seem to be much less affected by the fungus, and they may well ramp up their numbers to fill the niche that's being vacated by the species that can't cope with white nose syndrome. And I think, there's a lot of gloom and doom out there in the world of bat experts, but there's also, I think, a lot of optimism that sooner or later the bats will turn this around. What I've done here on the farm has nothing to do with making a direct response to white nose syndrome. No one knows how to tackle that fungus per se. But if the bats are going to recover, they're going to need some high-quality habitat that's being maintained as high-quality habitat. And that was something I was able to do.
Don Mitchell is author of the book Flying Blind, One Man's Adventures Battling Buckthorn, Making Peace with Authority, and Creating a Home for Endangered Bats. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.